Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hey, listeners. This episode of the Battlestar Galactic cast may feature spoilers for events that come later on in the series. So be warned.
Be warned.
All ministers and officials should now go to Case Orange. Repeat, this is an official colonial government broadcast.
Hello, and welcome to the last episode of the Battlestar Galactic cast. Well, not quite, but the penultimate. Kind of, mostly. Yeah, yeah, let's do it. The last
episode. It's the finale.
It's the finale.
We just got a couple specials and the plan to do.
Indeed. But, you know,
Did you just say indeed?
I just said indeed because I'm verklempt at the fact that we're coming to the end. But yes, my name is Mark Bernardin.
And I am Trisha Helfer. Sorry. We're getting to the end of this and I'm like, I'm not even following protocols anymore.
Yeah,
I'm
just cutting you off. But yes, today we are going to talk about Daybreak Part 3. And we thought early on, we would sort of end the podcast the way we began the podcast. It would be, you know, me and Trisha and a whole mess of cats and lots of Benadryl to keep me from sort of seizing my respiratory system. But then we also thought, wouldn't it be great? Wouldn't it be the best if we had a guest? And wouldn't it be great if we had a guest that we haven't really had before? And like, you know, the most Titanic of Titanic guests. And Trisha said, yeah. And so she got after it and made all good things happen, as Trisha so often does. And so rather than spend the end of the days alone, we're going to spend it with our president, with the president. Mary McDonald is here, everybody. Hi, Mary.
Hello. Oh, I'm so thrilled. It's very emotional to hear the two of you say you're at the end.
Yeah, I mean,
it's an amazing thing you've done, and I congratulate you sincerely. Really,
thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been, I wasn't prepared for how emotional this would be, because we're just barreling along. It's like fourth season, yay, cool things are going to happen. Yeah.
And or you're like, oh my God, how many in this season?
Is this the longest season ever? I think it is.
It is, yeah.
But, you know, what began is just sort of a lark and just, you know, fun and, you know, getting to be friends with Trisha, who I sort of know a little bit or knew a little bit before this. But then getting, you know, closer with her this way, you know, and then doing, you know, almost two seasons in quarantine.
Yeah.
It has become something of a lifeline.
I think
something of a both purpose in a time when purpose seemed elusive, connection at a time when connection seemed distant.
Yeah.
And so coming to the end of it is both, you know, this incredibly fulfilling feeling of we did something, you know, we did it soup to nuts. We put a thing into the world and a thing that we believe in, but also it's, you know, those, that purpose and that connection is starting to fade a little bit. And so it's bittersweet, I think.
Oh, completely. And you know, it's, I was thinking about it the last hour or so as I was sort of looking at things and getting ready to be with you all. And you really did enliven the show again. Do you know what I mean? In a new way. I truly believe that, because the ability to really look at these episodes and have people come on and talk and have new viewers listening and old viewers, the opportunity to exercise this overwhelming feeling of nostalgia that we are all dealing with, it comes over us now in COVID. It's just a blessing. So thank you.
No, well, thank you, Mary.
You're welcome.
I mean, coming at a time in this particular time period that we're going through too, it's just the show is, we just continue to talk about how relevant it still is and everything. And I think that the timing of us doing this and the what's happening in the world and everything, is just this weird grouping of timing or of not events, but timing. And so, yeah, it does feel a little unique, not unique to have done it right now, but
it's kind of been that way with the show. I mean, the show has the legend. This show has always been sort of in the zeitgeist, as it were. Do you know what I mean? Because remember when we first started shooting, it was just post 9/11. I remember watching Saddam Hussein's statue come down from, you know, the Sutton Place Hotel in my room on the TV. I mean, there were so many things that the show was poking around at that were happening. And once again, it still is. You know what I mean? With all of these new current horrific events, frankly.
Yeah, absolutely. And certain episodes really pinpoint, I mean, the entire through line of the show.
Yeah.
Does, but then also certain episodes, like The Woman King or things like that, that dealt with a pandemic on board. And but yeah, it's, and with this particular episode too, is like, don't want to jump ahead too far, but the way it ends with kind of taking a step back is something that parallels what I know we've all talked about to some extent of, you know, the earth got a bit of a breather with us.
Yes.
With this global pandemic. And, yeah. And it sort of parallels a lot of that too, of watching yourself and seeing, of course, we all want it to get back to somewhat normal. We never will get back to normal, but the new normal. But what can we learn from what we've been going through this year? How can we improve society and how can we improve ourselves? And, you know, can we be less materialistic? Can we be less this or that and get back to the soul of humanity? And I know one of the characters I've written it down here, has a speech about it. And that's one thing we should pay attention to as a society, I think.
Mm. Yeah, I agree with you. And it seems to me like you were referring to too as well, Mark, at the beginning, is that the thing that I think we're learning that's clear so far, and that we have so much to go through before we really see where we are, but inclusiveness and connection during the pandemic, we suddenly understand, or not suddenly, very painstakingly understand that nothing else matters. If we don't get how we are included as a body of one, and we in any way separate or disclude or put on certain levels of the way that we're thinking, the way we're behaving, we're not going to get out of this in a progressive manner. We could be stalled in a rather troubling way for a long time.
Yeah.
And connection just feels so good, right? When you just see people, like as soon as I saw you guys on the screen, my heart jumped. Do you know what I mean? And I remember doing podcasts before the pandemic, and you know, you might do an interview on FaceTime or something, and you're like, hi. You know, and I saw you guys come up, and it was like, oh, my heart. Be still my heart. That's a beautiful thing to learn, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. Yeah.
You know, it's the ropes are stronger for having more strands in them.
Oh, that's beautiful. I'm going to write that down. I've got my
notes. So the more people we can include in the story, the better the story will be.
And that's the right.
Telling the story will be.
Right. Correct. And I do need to correct you though, because I was on once before, Mark.
You were indeed. We didn't talk specifically about an episode. It was more like, let's just talk to Mary for an hour.
Where were we? We were in Seattle.
Yeah, we were at a convention. You were one of our special episodes.
Yeah, you came to Seattle.
Yes, Emerald City Comic Con, and we did in front of a crowd of 400 or 500 people, and that was a blast.
Yeah, it was a blast.
Yeah, but we wanted to have you to, you know, sit down and talk and dig into, you know, the specific episode, and of There's plenty of episodes we could have had you on that would have been perfect, but this feels like, this felt like the one.
Great.
Yes. So shall we get into it?
Yes, we shall. And right as you're pressing play, quick previously on Battlestar Galactica, we obviously had Daybreak Part 2 with Ron Moore joining us one last time to chat all things creator, showrunner, everything, which was absolutely a treat as normal whenever he comes on. And basically it's, you know, we're setting up the final mission, the final jump. Hera's been kidnapped and the entire fleet is focused on getting her back. And that's the main goal. Indeed. They have no idea where they're going to land. And truthfully, it seems like Adama thinks it's going to be a one-way mission. So,
yeah. And we've also been flashing back to see sort of the beginnings of these stories. Right. You know, the beginnings of Kara and Lee, the beginnings, or at the very least, the potential end of one career for Bill Adama and his decision to double down and be a commander of a Battlestar. Laura Roslin's decisions, you know, or the events that push her to the decision to join Adar's campaign, the catastrophic loss she suffers, and a desire to find purpose in politics and service. And yeah, lots of stuff blew up too, because they just leaving it all on the field, as the sports metaphor goes, just blowing it all up. We're spending all the money.
Some pretty badass VizFX shots of Galactica jumping into to the colony.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
Yeah.
And there was a tentative peace between the Cylons.
Did your just guitar drop?
My guitar just dropped.
Oh dear! Oh no!
Yeah, it's all right.
Maybe yeah, that's what the Cylons thought of you saying there was the tentative.
Tentative piece. We will ruin your instrument, sir. And yeah, and so now we're into it proper, you know, at the, you know, sort of piece where the Cylons have stood down in exchange for the secrets to resurrection. And, you know, humanity has stood down in exchange for getting to reunite Hera with her family. And all we're doing is, man, we're just waiting for the codes, ultimately. How do we concoct the recipe of resurrection?
Which is up to the final five.
Indeed.
Right? They each have a piece. Right.
They've each got a piece of it. We talked a lot with Ron about his philosophy on endings, the kinds of things that he, as a storyteller, wants to highlight and reinforce, and what he thinks an audience wants to take out of it. Mary, when you... I'm sure there's no way to know what this character's arc was going to be when you first signed on to Battlestar. But as you come to this fourth season, and as, you know, the realities of Laura Roslin and her cancer and her treatment and the lack of a cure, what kind of things were you hoping for Laura when she got to the end of this particular line?
Well, first, let me say that when this role was, and I've told the story before, but I don't think I've ever... spoken about it to you, Mark, or Tricia, maybe. But when I first was offered the role, and I asked if I could have a meeting with Ron and David and Michael Reimer before I signed on, I was raising a middle schooler at the time. I knew, and I thought, well, I needed to be with people that I liked if I was going to, you know, sort of compromise my parenting, as it were. Do you know?
Mm-hmm.
I said to Ron that day, we were at breakfast, and I said, now, Ron, I do have a question. Like, you know, is this a short-lived role or a long role? Because she's dying of cancer in the first scene. And, you know, he basically said very quietly and very humbly, as is his graceful way, oh, no, no, I will find a path in and out of remission for her, and she will die at the end when they find Earth. Mm. So I knew, and I believed him, and he was true to his word. So when the fourth season came around, I knew what would be the end. I wasn't sure how we would get there. And what I didn't know, and what I was delightfully surprised by, was... how how ready Laura, completely ready Laura is to die as part of her canon, you know, as part of her completion, as it were. Do you know what I mean? Because there's no more resistance and it's done and they're all together and whatever confusions or sort of misleads that she felt she, tributaries she went down that either she regretted or questioned later, felt in the final moments fine. And when she, when I was looking at her and I can finally look, I was saying to Trisha, when I shoot, at least in my whole career, until maybe now, because I want the third act to be different. You know what I mean? I want to be able to look at what I do. I want to wear my hair white if it is. I want, you know, this is it, right? And I was looking at her and I thought, you know, she had earned such a kind of snorting, comfort, healthy cynicism when she died that she did not have at the beginning. So that when Adama says, you know, it's Earth, she snorts. And says, well, yeah, okay, we'll call it Earth then, sure, fine. And I thought, that was really, you know, those were the surprises. That the little, Laura's an economic role. Like, you don't get a lot of explanation with Laura as to what, but it was so specific, the way he ended her. And that surprised me, that she had that much, she was just present with it. She didn't have anything to, it was sad, but not really, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the episode, I can't remember the name of it, but it's when you spend most of it in the sick bay with Nana Visitor. Who's, you know, fantastic actress. And she's also dealing with a sickness, and she's on, you know, knocking on death's door, and that character figures out how to make that transition. Right. And then you see these scenes of Laura, like on a boat, you know, staring off at her family on the far shores, and is she ready to get off of that boat and go into the West with her people? And she's no, not yet. She hasn't. The dying leader has not yet led humanity to its end.
Right.
But at the very least, it felt as if at that moment she found a peace with it. Yeah. You know, she wasn't fighting it anymore. She said, no, this is inevitable. But I have to find a way to live with it and be able to chuckle through it. in ways that only Laura Roslin could.
Yeah, but you know what? I don't think she could have, that Laura Roslin we knew at the beginning could not have chuckled at that. And that's what I really loved when I went back and looked, is that Laura's owning of her own wisdom by the end. That's a nice thing to see in a woman.
Yeah.
Well, in any kind of like that.
But yeah, and it's such a small move. I mean, Laura goes through a lot over the course of it, but her, the thing that animates her soul is relatively small. Like, it's not a massive shift.
Right.
It's just it's a tweak in perspective that allows her by the end.
Yeah, that's lovely. Well,
rarely did you see her falter, right? I mean, she has what she, you know, certainly, like you said, Mary, things that she thinks maybe she would have done differently, or, you know, maybe guided wrong, whatever, but she went with her heart. And I mean, the only time really that I can think she kind of lost it for a while was after finding Earth. And she just holds up in Adama's quarters for a while and just basically gives up. But that's also part of her process, right? Of needing to get past that and through that and come out tougher on the other side.
Correct. Yeah, there's a couple of those moments, but that's a perfect one to look to. She did have moments of soul reckoning along the way.
Absolutely.
And she didn't spend a lot of time there as a character. Ron didn't leave her there a lot. Do you know what I mean? He got her out of there pretty quickly each time. You know what I had this thought about, and I wanted to talk about it with you all, is Laura Roslin. Do you think that had Adama not, to a certain extent, beautifully usurped her conscience? That's the way it felt to me. Do you think she would have been, that she really truly was ready to steal the election? And I'm wondering, if that didn't take some reckoning inside of her that you're on New Caprica, that the fact that she hadn't done it. He was worried about what would happen to her soul if she did. And I'm interested sometimes to wonder, because she was crystal clear about stealing it. It wasn't easy, but she knew it was right for humanity. And so I just love that there's still these questions, you know what I'm saying, for all of us, really.
Yeah, and it's left up to the viewer for them to decide for themselves, right?
Right.
Yeah, because in that moment, Laura Roslin is doing the very thing she swore she would never do.
Right.
But you 100% understand why she's doing it and want her to do it. As an audience member, you're like, steal the election. Of course you have to do that.
Steal it because it's the fate of everyone is at stake. That's her commitment.
Yeah.
Her commitment was never to be a great president or a good politician or anything like that. She didn't want to be. She had to be.
So it was for the survival of humanity. And it's, you know, it started with her marking every baby born or every person lost on that board.
Yeah. Well, you remember all the way back in the pilot, the Colonial One evacuated Geminon. Remember? And O'Donnell wanted her to go. And she said, no. That's where she began, saying we need to save the fleet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting.
Everything's about the fleet. And I love that decision on Adama's part, you know, drives a wedge between them for a little bit because he took something from her.
Yep.
You know, and she doesn't let him off the hook for that. He understands that I'm going to be a villain for doing this in this woman's eyes, but it has to be done. Mm-hmm. It's two people who realize that something has to be done. Yeah. One of which is facing like an emotional fallout and the other one is facing a political fallout.
Yeah.
And I love that those characters, every character finds a way to be at cross purposes in ways that you wouldn't have expected them.
No, that's Ron never lets go of what's really confoundingly ambivalent in all of our souls. Like the tossing and turning of being a human being is so clear to Ron. And you see it in everyone's decision making and the experiences they have getting to moments that are epiphanies for them. Nothing happens easily, but it happens beautifully, you know?
You know, like we sort of glossed over this moment when, you know, all the Cylons need to sort of merge in the data stream to be able to assemble the codes for resurrection. But when they merge, all of their memories will start to flow through to each other also. And in that moment, the memory that Tori has of killing Chief Tyrell's wife comes forward and he sees it, loses his mind justifiably, kills her. The download is over. The Cylons attack. Everybody's gunfire again. And that's why Kara jumps them to all along the Watchtower coordinates to Earth.
Perfect.
Only because of one purely emotional moment on Chief Tyrell's part. Like he gets a piece of information that rocks him to his core and suddenly everything else is up for grabs.
Right. And we find the plan.
Yeah. And it's purely out of character. Like it's plot serving character, not character serving plot. And I love it for that.
Yeah, I do too. I know. I looked at that as well in a kind of odd manner when I was looking at the episode is that that was such a stroke of simplicity that brought something that had been four seasons of complexity into focus. It just, how are you pulling, how Ron Moore are you going to pull it together? You know what I mean? Well, let's download the memories. And then he gets to read, he sees what she did and kills her. And because of that, Kara has to have the courage to follow along the Watchtower. And where are we? We're on Earth.
Right. And would she have had that moment of, you know, being able figuring it out and the being put under the pressure and just following her gut and the faith of what was happening, if that one very human moment from a Cylon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know. Right.
Right.
It's fantastic. It's nothing is what it seems.
Yeah. You
know? And that's sort of what it was talking about.
In one moment, three disparate storylines that have been building for 4 years find resolution. Yeah. You know, literally one moment. And yeah, it's a magic trick.
I think Ron was done. I mean, I should honestly, that was the day. Ron said, you know what, I can't do this anymore.
I remember shooting in the CIC. Mary, do you remember when we're all in there and we know it's the last, right? And the CIC is just beat to shit. And that, you know, where the explosions and everything's happening. And it's like, it was so sad just being in that CIC that it was always like the hub, the main area, and it's just falling apart. And when Ty says, you know, the girl's broke her back and she's never going to jump again and everything, it's like, you're just like, you're almost crying over a ship. And,
I know you are. Yeah.
And we're all like in this emotional place because it's the finale, and just being in that demolished CIC was hard to film in, I remember.
I know. I remember it too, Tricia. And I remember feeling really interestingly small. Maybe it was because I was sitting on the floor and Laura was kind of weak, but I think it was more than that. I think that the enormity of what had happened in the CIC for four seasons, do you know what I mean? Mm. Was hitting me. And I just felt so... Mary felt completely sort of childlike in a way, watching it fall apart and watching us all fall apart. And you just sort of think, wow, we are nothing in a way, because it can all, it was just a beautiful feeling of feeling like tiny and nothing. I know it probably makes absolutely no sense, but I didn't feel like Laura Roslin, if you know what I mean. Like, and perhaps she didn't have Laura Roslin. That Laura Roslin was leaving too, you know what I mean? And her body was dying and everything. But I do remember what you're referring to, Tricia. It was overwhelming.
It's almost like giving up to the moment, right? Or getting into the moment and just of what, you know, Roslyn, everybody had gotten that far, and it's just, it's all happening and just kind of giving in to what's going to happen next.
Right. Yeah. Surrender.
Yeah.
Just surrender. And that is the only way we made it to that planet. Like you were saying, Mark, too, if Kara in that moment hadn't surrendered to the pressure that she was forced to feel through what happened with the chief's memory and Totori, et cetera, we wouldn't have survived.
Yeah.
And everyone's intertwined, right? Like you just said, if it had all the pieces to play, it wasn't one character or one.
No.
I'm sorry, Fiona keeps sneezing. If you hear this little, that's just my cat, folks.
We can't hear it.
You can't hear it?
No.
I'm getting lots of little sprays on my leg, but it's just this tiny little. You've seen it like 30 times. Anyway, sorry. But it's all these like pieces. Everybody's intermingled, right? It's and relying on each other. And that's one thing I think we need to do more, like, you know, in this time period we're in right now as well.
Yeah.
Us, ourselves.
Yeah.
And also that idea of surrendering. You know, that like nobody in the finale, nobody's fighting it.
Nope.
Nobody's fighting anything. It's all right, Sam, you're going to pilot Galactic into the sun. I got this. I'll see you on the other side. Poor guy. Didn't even get to put on a shirt.
Amazing.
Which is the first time we hear him speak, right? After he was, aside from his babbly stuff gobbly in the beginning. Gobbledygook.
Yeah.
This is the first time we've heard him say something.
Like he sort of pierces through and Sam manages to say, I'll see you on the other side. But, you know, everybody, all the survivors who were left are surrendering to the fact that they're on a new planet and they're not going to build new cities and they're not going to do it how it was, that they're just going to kind of explore and blend in and be, and not try to do this all over again.
That's the beautiful thing, isn't it? That it was a collective reckoning with surrender. And that is the lesson, I think you're right, Tricia, that we are struggling with right now in our culture. The paradigms are collapsing. We are at risk. And are we going to be able to surrender and be present with just something very organically beautiful about being alive? Mm. Or will we go back out there when this is over and get busy again?
It's almost like we're going through the finale, the very end scene, right? In our own way right now.
Yes, except not going to die.
No, I mean the New York at the very end.
The very end. We're in Times Square. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Times Square. Yeah. With Baltar and Six talking like, is humanity going to make it this time?
I do think that this time for us is allegorical to the Galactica in that it feels to me like we must learn it. It's not like, can we? And if we don't, will we sort of live kind of what it was like pre-COVID and pre-Trump, if I may, or are we really being held to count here? Like, do we need to really surrender to living differently in order to have this beautiful earth?
And it feels at least for children, or the next children's generation.
Correct.
Yeah. Correct.
Yeah. We're very much in a season finale.
get out the wine.
And so I'm hoping that there's a reboot of this particular show we're living in. And then the next season is incredibly different. Some of the same characters, but different roles. Some people will get their comeuppance. Some people will rise. But where did you guys shoot this? Is this Vancouver?
This was Kamloops area, wasn't
Kamloops.
It?
Kamloops, correct.
Yeah, interior of British Columbia.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Oh. Yeah.
I do. This is such a beautiful scene. Sorry, Mary, go ahead.
No, go ahead. You go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I love the scene of Adama leaving, the last one to leave, and him flying around the ships and the fleet and, flying around the Galactica. And then you come to this and you see Sam flying the fleet into the sun.
Yeah.
And then this beautiful scene between you and Eddie watching the animals. And talking about Earth, naming it Earth, which you mentioned at the beginning, and your little snort.
Yeah. You know what I realized is, how Tricia, quite often people will say to us in panels or in interviews, they'll say to actresses, and they might say this to you as a writer, Mark, they'll say, did you have an inspiration for this scene or that scene? Or what were you thinking about? Or did you use a memory? And I'm always feeling like, no, I don't, because I don't work in a self-conscious manner, and I don't know half the time when I've finished what I've done. You know what I mean? So I'm kind of hard to work with that way, or not hard to work with, but hard to relax with. But when I was looking at this, I was so, it broke my heart because I realized I saw my mother in the last moment I had with my own mother before she died of breast cancer. And I had no idea, Mary had no idea that snort cynicism kind of balls out practical woman that my mother had found as she lost her hair and she lost weight and she became right there, that I was playing my mother until the last couple of days when I took a look at this. Isn't that
so? Wow. I didn't 15 know. 15 years later watching it, you...
Yeah. You use your life, but you don't always know you're using it because you don't want to know because you'll get upset.
Yeah.
You gotta use it without commenting on what you're using.
But it's seeping in. You can't help but have it seep in, right? And that's when, if you're not, that's actually beautiful that came around and you were able to use it that way without really knowing it at the time, because it might have actually taken you out a little bit at the time.
Correct.
Because it would have been too personal at that moment.
That's right.
But that the fact that you actually could use that and use elements of it, and that you recognize 15 years later, that's beautiful.
It's a very cool thing, right? And it made me realize, oh, this has worked out well for me now. I'm going to go back and watch all my... For the rest of COVID, I will be watching myself, darling, and finding out what I've used from my life.
But it's a thing I tell young writers all the time.
Yeah.
It's you have to go and live a life. You have to go and do things. You have to go see things. You have to open yourself up to any number of emotional experiences, because you don't know how it's going to affect the work, but I guarantee you it will. You know, like travel, go meet people, get your heart broken, do all of those things. And not that you have to go and write about your trip to, you know, Tanzania where you got your heart broken, but it'll be in there. And you'll never know when it'll come. And you'll never know that you even tapped into it, but it'll be there for you if you need it.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Oh, I feel so bad for everybody in this scene.
I know. It's like...
It's really hard to watch.
It was interesting for me to see, because Katie has two lover goodbyes in it, right? Yeah. And the difference between the Sam and then what we're going to see, obviously we're seeing... beautiful scene with Rosalind and Dama and Lee and Kara. But then this with just Lee and Kara, the strength that she has and the surrender that she has in this scene.
That's right.
Doc, that word surrender again, the surrender she has compared to with Sam, that it was just a different loss. Like
I agree with you, Tricia. I think the choice that Katie made there. Reimer directed this one, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. I love him so much. Mm-hmm. The choice that she made there, what Katie knew and what Reimer knew and what Ron knew about what the being, whatever the being of Kara Thrace is, the angel, the whatever you want to label her, if you must. Was so astonishingly wise. And Kara Thrace thrashed her way through life. She didn't have an implicit wisdom. She worked it out emotionally, physically. She was courageous. She took chances. She fucked up. She rescued. She did. Do you know what I mean? Her journey was so physical and emotional. And in that last moment, she was completely wise. And I just love that.
Yeah, it was nice to see that in her. This, like you said, this wild character that just has come to this knowledge and just steadiness. Yeah.
Yeah. And she as well, she verbalizes it, has completed her purpose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So where does she go off to?
Going, but she knows her. Yeah, she's done.
She's done.
Yeah.
I remember the first time I saw this sequence specifically, I was, and this would have been whatever, 15 years ago. I was a little put off only because, you know, the Kara Thrace disappearing into the ether of it felt weird to me, you know, just in a show that had been so fundamentally about reality.
Yeah.
But I can't even put a finger on it, why it doesn't bother me this time around.
Isn't that interesting, Mark? Yeah,
like there's it must just be that we're living in these character truths, and who is this character? What is her purpose? What is she here for? And at some point you surrender to the idea that this character is all of these things and none of these things, you know, and that if she vanishes into the ether like an angel, that's fine, you know, and some things don't need explanation, You know, like there has been quite a bit of explanation in the show, but there's also the idea that, you know, as many characters have said in the final season, what are the odds that we would be on this place at this time? You know, there has to have been something divine at work here, that you would have the notes of that song and you would hear the memories of another woman killing your wife, and you would, all of these things are improbable and impossible, but they happen. And so why can't this also be a thing that's improbable and impossible and happen?
Right.
You know, I couldn't see it.
Well, you were 15 years younger. Mm. That too, right?
Yeah.
This is something I noticed recently, and I thought about it as I was watching this for this. In the last couple of years, and this is specifically to Rosalind, but I think it speaks to what you're saying. And I particularly noticed this. I went to a convention in Munich in December, pre-COVID. Mm. That was the last convention I did. And probably will do for a very long time. And all of us, right? And oh, so sad. Oh, my God. But I have been noticing, and Trisha, I think that you'll get a kick out of this. When we first started doing conventions, right, I always had, like, long lines, people like Rosalind, yada, yada. But, like, the young men in their 20s and 30s would come past my table and go, "Yo, Madam President," as they were rushing to Trisha's line and Katie's line and Grace's line, understandably. You know, "Hey, Mom, how you doing, MP?" But, and what has started to happen, and I noticed particularly this year, my lines at conventions now have more young men in them, in their 20s and 30s. They were 10 when this came out. They were 8 when this came out. And these young men, because I finally started asking, like, "How come you want my autograph?" I mean, he didn't say that because that would, like, be too vulnerable, but basically exploring the idea with them. And I realized that I'm talking to men, young men, who don't have layers of gender bias to get through. And they're seeing Battlestar for the first time. And they have grown up in a time when they have been seeing older female leaders. Mm. And this particular convention was in Germany. So they grew up under Angela Merkel. They have seen, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, perfect mm-hmm. example of cultural shifts. So I think, Mark, as the show has a sustainable quality to it that is allowing different generations and even us as we age and go back and look at it, there's so much wisdom in it that we then get a new experience from it. And something that we lost last time or didn't quite connect mm-hmm. with no longer bothers us. And I saw that. I'm seeing that in young men who can relate to Rosalind more easily as not just a mother or grandmother figure, but as a power.
Yeah, I never, that's fascinating. I never understood. My mother was like this. She would go to a museum over and over and over again, years between going to museums. And, like, she would have a favorite piece of art that she would go and walk up to in, like, 10-year intervals. I'm like, "But Mom, it's the same picture. Like, the picture, they haven't changed it since you were here last." But it was, you know, she has changed since she was there last. And so art has this, you know, infallible ability to reflect ourselves back at us. And we are the things that are changing in between times we behold it. And great art gets to do that. And Battlestar absolutely qualifies as, "Oh, I'm a different person. And now I'm taking all of this in differently than I did before. I feel weird and funny." But here for it.
Yeah. And this scene, right as we're talking about this, right as the scene of Rosalind's passing happens. And it's such a, I remember talking to Eddie in one of the podcasts. Mark, do you remember when he was talking about this scene? Mm-hmm. Saying that it was so hard for you guys to get through because you would start crying, but you were dead.
Yeah. And Reimer would go, cat, you got tears. She's dead. You know what I mean? I have a terrible Australian accent, but it was like that. It was like, and I'd be like, "Michael, I know, but you don't understand. Like, I can't not respond to Ed. Okay, we'll do it again. It was just us. And this is the bizarre thing about that ending, that scene. We were not supposed to shoot it that day.
Really?
We were supposed to shoot it the last day. But then, and so I'm in a hotel room in Vancouver, and I was going to leave the next morning and fly home for 5 days and come back up for the finale. And I got a call from Ron. And he goes, oh my God, I really hate to do this to you. And I'm like, what could you possibly do? We're at the end.
You're already killing me. What else can you do?
I know. Like, where do we go? You've got nowhere to go, bud. And he said, you've got to shoot your final scene tomorrow. I was nowhere ready. Do you know what I mean? I was like, I have to go back to LA first. I got to do this. And then I'll get ready and I'll come back and I'll be there and I'll be there with everyone at the end and we'll just do it and that will be wonderful. And he said, no. And I can't remember specifically what the rearrangement was about. You might know, Tricia, or maybe you didn't even know.
I didn't. I'm not remembering it right now, but
right. Well,
I know there were some issues with Kamloops and things like James and I had to reshoot. We're not at it yet. Or we're coming up to it when James and I are talking about being farmers and, you know.
Yeah.
Our kind of emotional little send off as we walk away. And we shot it in Kamloops and then we had to reshoot it in the back of the studio, standing on top of like a garbage bin, basically, to get just sky behind us. So there's elements that are used of us here where you see the backdrop, but then
right. There's
this one angle that's like looking up at us. And that we had already shot it. We'd already had our kind of emotional farewell. I mean, it's not the same as your scene where you're passing away, but it's.
Yeah.
And we had to reshoot it. So because there was some issue and it was so hard to go back.
No, God.
Just like it's like hard to bring something like that up and jump into it sooner when you're preparing yourself for it.
It's harder even to go back.
To go back, you're like, you've got it and you're done. And you're like, and then
downloaded it, for God's sake. And then you have to go back and upload it.
Right. And from a beautiful vista of Kamloops to like the vista to the back of like, you're in the garbage dump area of the studio lot. It was like, I remember we were both looking at each other going, how are we going to do this?
I know. It was really, it was something. And I remember that when we shot our scene, that scene that we start talking about, there were very few people on the set. It was the middle of the night and it wasn't the end really, but we were shooting our end or my end or her end. And suddenly, and it was very difficult, actually. It was very difficult and it didn't. And then it was done and it was the middle of the night and nobody was there. Mm-hmm. Except me and Eddie and Michael Reimer and my son Michael, who filmed the whole thing, you know. So I have a little, you know. Michael was in film school, I think, at the time, or he was shooting films for high school or junior high or something. And it had a kind of empty. Now what do we do?
Wow.
And then I went back to LA, and I didn't come up for the end.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, because for that would have been green screen, right? And you're sitting in a Raptor, so you wouldn't have had to have the massive amounts of crew and everything. So they would have.
Yeah, but the guys who were, you know, worked with us with green screen, and they were lovely. Me and Reimer and Eddie and my son were all crying, but there was nobody there. And I was like, I'm done. I'm dead. Oh my God. You know, wow. And it was really lovely in a way in the long run because I didn't have the opportunity to romanticize it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it happened. And that's how life is. You die. And then you grieve, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember why I couldn't come back up because I think the intention was I would just come up and hang out for the last day. I don't know if it was that something in my personal life took over or it was just that having finished the idea of stepping back into it felt alien. I don't know. I don't
have a quiet ending like that too. Cause I remember, I feel like I was on the last day. They might've had some second unit, Raptor type stuff.
Right.
But I remember the big celebration of the, you know, and some, I have some video and pictures that Dennis Illick took of it. And it was late at night, you know, middle of the night. And it was some of that corridor shooting stuff.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like emotionally grounded scenes or anything like that. That was the ending that would have felt like, oh, coming back for that would have been something. Like if you had done your scene at the end, this was just gunfight and fire and whatever. And I just remember that that's like, I was running around with an AK-47 for the finale scene. And then the champagne comes out at like 4 o'clock in the morning. And that was the ending. So that could have also been the reason you're like, I'm coming up for like madness as opposed to.
Yeah. I don't really remember. I just know that in my career, the endings always have something in them that's a surprise. They never end with the scene you think they will. It never feels quite like you think it will. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Because it's an ending. It can't. You're already feeling grief, so you drink champagne. Do not. Mm-hmm. Everything gets fuzzy really quickly, you know, and then you go home.
Ooh. Yeah.
I just made myself sad.
Looking back at this, I have to say, I think this watching this just before we started, was the first time I kind of looked at it and went, I think I would have preferred the ending being Eddie with the cabin and your burial site.
Yeah.
And ending there, knowing that because the Cylons and humans and, you know, Hera was the future and everything. Knowing this part,
right,
this last scene of in New York, as opposed to us showing it, and it's done in a, it's we're kind of cheeky, and you know, I don't know. I just watched it, and I went, I would have rather ended with Eddie, and then having all this be the point. This is the point of the series, right? Mm. Can you change? Can you, you know, learn and grow and whatever? Not the point of the series, but you know what I mean, and. Where it this felt like sort of exposition to me after the emotion of the other scenes.
That's so funny. Trisha, I had exactly the opposite response.
Really?
Because I remember at the time, and it wasn't, and like I said, I didn't really watch. I watched like this, bits and pieces, and I did check in on other people's work because it was so brilliant and everything, but I didn't watch my arc much. So I had kind of a strange experience with what. But when I read the ending, when I read the series, I went, oh, why do we have to come out like you're saying now? And what is that going to be? And then I did see the ending and it was so startlingly odd and what have you. When I watched it this time, I went, oh my God, that is such a brilliant ending. Because of the way it reverberates given where we are now.
Right. Yeah.
I went, oh, Ron, how do you see this? Mm-hmm. How do you see this coming? How he's such a visionary.
Yeah.
My feeling.
I may be skewed with it because like you, I don't like watching myself. So kind of like, I mean, I do like saying I was in the opening scene and the ending scene of the entire series. Yeah, so my little ego goes, yeah, well, it was the opening and the ending.
But that is also cool that you and she are there in the opening and the ending. I think that's really an awesome part of all of this. Because, first of all, your performance, the more I watch, the older I get, the more your performance is just astonishing with all the different women you play. But the beginning and ending with that woman is really important to us. I think, because the danger of being alive is unquestionable. And she always represents both danger and hope. Mm-hmm. In the beginning and in the end. And I think that that's very, very cool to me.
It's a beautiful way to look at it. Yeah.
I never wasn't slightly afraid of her. No matter, you know what I mean? No matter what she was doing, you know,
right.
You know, I would be like, and then I go, whoa, where are we going now, my Lord? And even in the end, it was the same thing. It was like, oh, they're in times. she's there. She's going to be there forever. She's going to be around. That's so great, but woo. You know what I'm saying? And that there's something so consistent about the how she represents the experience of life with those two qualities, you know?
Yeah.
It's fascinating. I don't know, how did you feel when you were shooting that ending and the Times Square idea? What did it mean to you? Do you remember?
I didn't quite understand everything.
Yeah.
I didn't, talking about time periods, right? Being 15 years ago and being a new actor and being like, you know, I guess I wasn't a new actor at the end, but relatively. I remember being sort of slightly confused of what exactly is going on and what I'm trying to tell, and being nervous as all get out that Ron was there and I'm talking over his shoulder.
After all those years, all those women that he created for him, and he was there, and it made you nervous.
It made me nervous. I'm still nervous around Ron. If I'm in a room with Ron, I'm like, you're genius, and I'm just like a babbling idiot. And
that's lovely. Oh, that's such a lovely quality, Tricia. But anyway,
so I just didn't really know. I just kind of said, you know, I'm just going to, I mean, I understood on what I was saying, but I just didn't kind of fully grasp it, I don't think. And those scenes are awkward anyway, when there's lots of people and you're trying to make it look like Times Square. Like, they're not the easiest scenes technically, right? So they can kind of feel disjointed, yeah. Just the shooting of it.
Right.
So it wasn't I wouldn't say it was my favorite scene to shoot. But I didn't fully understand it at the time.
Right.
I kind of wish it could have come after the credits. You know what I mean? Because the emotional story ends on that hilltop with Adama, yeah. You know, and then no credits. Oh, here's like an epilogue.
A postscript.
You know, so that you can then do that kind of like, well, look, here's what happens. Here's information that's not emotional. The emotional story is over. But now let's give you the Twilight Zone twist of, yeah. Oh yeah, by the way, that was Earth. This is now. And are we going to do it again?
Bum, 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 bum.
Yeah, I love the music. Exactly.
Hendrix kicks in.
I know.
Mark, there was the fan interaction was 50-50, I think, with the finale.
Yeah.
And I don't really fully remember exactly what, I mean, I've been told so many times by people from both sides. And I think I've always gotten sort of defensive of the finale, you know, as an actor and being part of it and being so attached to it, and thinking it was a beautiful ending to the show. I always would say, you know, it wasn't wrapped up. What I liked about it, it wasn't like a completely disastrous, dire ending where everybody dies. And then it wasn't like everything wasn't perfect and, you know, everything wrapped up with a little bow. It was left open. You know, there was space to breathe in it. That makes sense. And what do you remember, Mark, what the main bone of contention was for the fans with the finale on the 50% side that hated it?
I think
you may have been one of them. I don't know.
No, I mean, I did say that I think it was Starbuck. Starbuck was the thing that people couldn't quite understand. And it requires a leap of faith, literally. And it's a thing that I don't think most fans, and definitely most fans at that time, like this is also Lost was airing and starting to come to its conclusion, and Lost was asking giant metaphysical questions about the world. And when Lost ended, it was very open-ended, very open to interpretation. And fans, I think, look to grind down and have their answers. They want to know, did these things connect? Did they make sense? And when a show like this ends, and lots of things do, but the emotional story is what Ron wanted to tell. And lots of plot lines do find their ways to resolve, but Starbucks is a giant one that just doesn't. And I feel like that was the thing that they felt a little bit betrayed by. Especially some of the fans who like, all right, listen, I don't want this Lady Starbuck, but I'll give you guys a few seasons. And then I gave you your seasons and Lady Starbuck is an angel? What the hell was that about? I never should have liked Lady Starbuck to begin with. I think, you know, I think that interpretation is not a thing that fans generally are down for when it's so wildly speculative. You know, like they just, they want to know that all the I's are dotted and all the T's are crossed, and Starbuck vanishing off the veldt is a giant non-dotted I and non-crossed T.
But you said
a leap of faith, and that's exactly what Baltar says in the episode of when, you know, with Cavill, the standoff is you have to take a leap of faith. Yeah.
Very often fans do not listen to what the show is telling them to do.
Well, you know, what is powerful about it, which I think is what you're saying, is the very reason that makes people resist something, is that it wasn't asking them to take a leap of faith. It was demonstrating faith. She was an angel and she's gone. You can't like break that down.
Right. You can't, so you can't describe, you can't.
It was faith. It is faith. To see it is faith. And a demonstration of faith is very frightening to people on a pure level. That that can happen with no explanation, and that there are potentially, there are spirits amongst us, and there is that kind of power in energy, and that she could do that after being so corporeal.
Yeah.
The most physical, most, you know, I understand the resistance, but that's what's great about it. Like, it's so challenging. And it would be really nice to talk to some of those dudes now, right?
I'm one of those dudes. Like, I was one of those dudes who for most of the show, I mean, it's science fiction. And so science is right there. It's the first of those two words. And so you expect there to be, you don't expect faith to be in your science fiction, even though from the jump, this was a show that told you faith is going to be part of your science fiction. And, you know, as characters began to interact and interface with faith, and it changed them here and there and kind of spun them here, you know, tither and yon, the show's relationship to that faith also evolved. And you as a viewer had to have your relationship with faith evolve as the show did. And some weren't able to, you know, simply because, like, you didn't tell me this was going to be the show when I signed on. It's like, well, we don't have to, but you're here with us, right? Like, you made it to the end, so you're on board. Why don't you take this last, like, walk with us? And I think that it was a hard thing, I think, for that audience to come to grips with. You know, even though Star Wars is nothing but space religion, and so they're totally fine with that. But this is like, it's robots, dude, and spaceships and laser beams and hard science and AI and defense and mainframes
and really human beings.
Yeah.
You know. Really, really, you know, blood and guts humans, you know, and now they're angels.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the leaps we're willing to take.
Yeah.
And then the ones we are not. And I feel like the finale of Battlestar was a very kind of cogent example of both of those, you know. But I think that, like we talked about before, time has, you know, softened me a bit. My resistances are down, and it hits me in the emotional place that I think it was designed to, which is a sense of like, we completed this thing and there were sacrifices along the way, and not everybody gets to make the trip. You know, we joked with Ron that last episode that he makes Hoshi the admiral of Battlestar when William passes it on, because there's no more people whose names we know. Literally everybody else is gone. Like, Dual is gone and that guy's gone. And you look around.
Gate is gone.
Gate is gone. Like, who's got a name we would recognize and a face that means something?
But it is perfect because in the through line, Rosalind was what? 40 what?
43rd.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Who knew Rosalind? Like, in that world prior to that moment, there was just this educator according to their biases.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we end up with Hoshi as and all something happened in between that was quite profound. But these people that aren't necessarily set up to be who they're about to become. Become that, and that's a beautiful idea. It's daring.
Yeah, like, what
it's
are
not
we
romantic, right? It's not romanticized. Like, it's Hoshi,
right? You know, it's what I like about it is it's somebody that's he's been there the entire time.
Yeah,
he's never aside from the mutiny episodes a little bit, but because of the webisodes with Gata's character, where you really got to understand that that's the most we saw of Hoshi and the relationship with Gata and everything. But he's a reliable, like he's there. He's been with everybody, you know, which kind of brings me to the frack down of the week, because Hoshi's involved. Mary, you probably don't know our frack down of the week. Not saying I'm trying to wrap things up, but I'm trying to incorporate Hoshi. Our frack down of the week is something of that stands out to you in the episode. Good, bad, funny, whatever. It could be anything.
Yeah, the most notable thing that you come away with.
And my frack down is not the most notable thing, but for some reason it keeps popping into my head. Mm-hmm. And it's the scene once they first land on the planet, and you've got Ty, Ty, Cottle, Adama, and Baltar. And then Hoshi comes in and gives him his admiral's, you know, when the fleet arrives, and gives him his admiral's wings back. And he's like, no, Lieutenant, Lieutenant is fine with me. The wings were a little bit too much for me. And I just love the line of these men that have been through so much, not necessarily men in this scene, they happen to be all men, but just that have been through so much. And they're, you know, they're looking at the primitive, you know, the humans on the planet, and talking about their primitive nature, and that they can mate with them.
When they're lined up with the binoculars?
Yeah.
Yes. And talking about, and Baltar goes, so we can mate with them. And Adama makes a joke about, you know, he's a one-track mind, and Baltar goes off about how he's talking about the survival of the human species. All these men just go, and you have no sense of humor. I just love, I don't know why, I just love that scene. So anyway, that's my frack down of the week. Given so many like amazing scenes, I had to choose one that really is neither here nor there, but it sticks out to me.
Well, it sticks out for me too, Trisha, but I'll tell you why. It's a completely different reason. It happened to me the first time I saw it, and it happened to me again. And I think I've seen it three times. It probably happened in the middle too. I pop out for that scene because I can't help but go, Ron, you ripped that off from Dances with Wolves. Go back and watch Dances with Wolves. They come up over the hill. It's Kevin and all the Indians and the guys, and they kind of crawl up to the top of the hill, and they look through this thing that's like a rudimentary telescope at the buffalo, and they make jokes. And I'm like, oh, I've been in that movie. All of this has happened before. All of this will happen again. And my life is really freaking me out right now. And that happened to me again.
I am so glad I had this as my frack down of the week, just so we got that story.
I never thought about it because I wasn't really clear about frack down of the week. But yes, I agree with you. That scene.
That's amazing.
I'm going to stick with that because isn't that funny? It's just totally flipped me right out of the thing. Like I had to like go and get some water.
Walk it off.
Start a couple seconds after. See if I missed something, but get rid of that image because I was like, wow, that's beautiful, isn't it? And I never asked Ron about it. So I hope you're listening, Ron, and you can call me and tell me if you did rip it off.
He put a nugget in there just for you.
But yeah, you should take a look. Just find that scene. I'm sure you can just YouTube it or something, that scene where they're looking at the buffalo.
I'm due a rewatch of the entire movie, so I think I should just watch.
you will laugh when you see it because it's also funny. It has a moment similar to what you're pointing out. So human. I can't remember what it is. Oh, I think it's that the Graham Greene's character, the Indian, looked through the binocular in the wrong way. Like he doesn't know how to use
it. He's got it.
Anyway, whatever. Oh. So that's my frack count.
Well done. mine is the a tiny little bit when Baltar and Six are on the savannah. And they're doing their bit where they're walking off before I think they talk to their head varieties. I can't remember what it is. And Baltar just says, you know, I know something about farming. And then starts to cry. And it's just, it's the most beautiful scene. And it's, and it's the kind of thing, I mean, we talked about it with Ron, we talked about it for a lot of this last run, of being able to pay off these long character stories of the thing that he had been running from his entire life was a life on a farm, of having that accent, of being rural, of being unsophisticated, but still having it all, having been that kid who grew up on Aralon, I think it was, just, you know, having dirt under his nails. And his entire life has been spent running away from that, only to find himself at the very end embracing it. And that's the kind of magic, the kind of narrative magic that just, it knocks me out every time I see it. Because some of it is clearly planned, but some of it is just, you know what? I remember in this moment, this is who this man is. Like I set the table for myself two seasons ago, and now I get to eat the meal at the very end by saying, oh, I know something about farming, and have that be the thing that breaks him and finally, you know, dispels his armor from him. Like, this is who Gaius Baltar is, and he's okay with it. You know, it only took him 4 years to be okay with it.
You know, and I love that too. And you know what I thought when I saw that this time? You know, the idea is in our understanding of narcissism that a narcissist can never change. And a narcissist doesn't know they're a narcissist. That's why they're so impossible. Because they don't really know that they are being totally selfish at all times. And when that moment came up in him, I felt the potential for, like you said, his armor went down. For me, it was, there is a soul inside the narcissist that remembers a pure desire to do something that perhaps was just a beautiful thing to be doing, but not at all self-serving. And that's how it felt to me when James Callis touched on whatever that truth was. And I thought, I saw Baltar without his selfishness was gone. It was so beautiful, right?
Yeah, just this perfect moment that tells you everything about this character. If you've been paying attention, which, you know, I can't imagine you've been watching this show for as long as it would take to get to the end, you haven't been paying attention.
Right.
The show that rewards that.
And fleshed out a little bit in these Daybreaks 1, 2, and 3 of the flashbacks and seeing him with his father. And so it was brought back to our kind of the forefront of our minds, as with all the characters and their flashbacks that we had in these last couple of episodes. But yeah, it's definitely brought back to the forefront of the viewers' minds of where he came from.
Yeah.
To lead up to that moment.
When we talked to Ron about it, like, so much of this felt, in his own description of it, like jazz. Where it's like, I had this image in my head of Mary in a fountain, and I didn't know what I was going to do with that. And I had an image in my head of Jamie chasing a pigeon, but I didn't know what it meant. But we're just going to shoot it and see what happens. You know, we're going to write it and see what happens. And then later he would tie in like, oh no, the pigeon he's chasing that goes out the window is actually Starbuck that had been chasing the entire show and could never catch and is just going to disappear. And, you know, she's the thing he could never have, and that's okay. Yeah. You know,
and that is talent, what you're describing. And you were describing it before as you, when you work with writing students or people that you're, and what you were talking about, Trisha, in terms of acting, is sort of surrender. Again, it brings us back to surrender. It's like, if you can surrender to the images and the unconscious or the subconscious that comes up when you're doing your work, you really don't know where you're headed. And then suddenly it reveals to you that you've just told a whole canon. You've just completed something. It's talent, what you're describing.
It's talent and it's trust. It's trust. You know, like you're trusting that you will find a soft place to land. But you will still jump off of this ledge. And I'll figure it out. It'll be okay. Don't worry.
Something will happen. Absolutely happened. I also want to say, Trisha, your reception of that moment with Baltar, or Trisha's actress reception of James's moment of revelation, was so beautiful in that. And I thought about your performance in retrospect, the amount of times that you, Trisha, were able to bring the simple act of compassionate reception to to the character of Baltar, as played by James. And it helped the entire arc work in a way that I'm not sure, I don't know if you, was that a choice?
Maybe subconsciously, but it was in the writing, because that's with Caprica in the more private moments, more toward the end, but with Head Six, he was able, that was the outlet for him to Head Six.
Still makes me laugh, Head Six. That, yes. Sorry.
That was the script. Yeah, I know, right? That was the outlet for him to show those more vulnerable moments, right? Because he wasn't showing them to, he had his guard up.
Yes. Right. But what I'm talking about isn't in the script. It's you. And that's talent too. You know, and I'm not just trying to blow smoke here. I really mean this. I think that there is a way that you were able to disarm our view of Baltar through the way that you received him. Because yes, you could talk about these things as written and say, you know, you could see that she had a certain compassion or an ability to help him investigate himself, mm-hmm. grow himself and all those things as it were in the writing. But particularly in that moment, I saw something that I witnessed all the way through in you, which is you bring to it, Tricia Helfer, a way of being very comfortable with receiving what's happening as you are observing it, rather than acting something about what you're seeing. Hmm. Does that make sense, Mark? Am I making sense to you? Because
no, totally.
I'm talking about Tricia to Tricia, and I know that can be like, do I know about this in me?
I don't know.
You know, what do I do? Yeah.
No, from out here where I sit as a non-actor person, it does make sense because, you know, it's not just the speaking, but the listening and how the listener listens. That makes it work. And yeah, there's so many just small, quiet things that are done by everybody. I mean, I have gone on the record. I've said it to anybody who would listen that this cast is maybe the best cast I've ever seen in a thing, especially given that so much of this cast didn't have, reams of experience, you know, that many were learning on the job. And for everybody to be able to perform at such a high level from the jump and then get better as it went on, is a remarkable thing to see. And you know, much of it is, you know, following good examples and good leadership. And so much of it is in the writing, but so much of it is just in the surrendering yourself to the scene and the moment and what it requires. And knowing when to play and knowing when to not play.
And, you know, I will say too, that I think that this, the idea of all of these, yourself included, Tricia, amazing performances that grew out of innocence and inexperience, I think, and then you have me, like me and Ed, the older people who could have been pain in the asses on a set if we weren't directed right. Do you know what I mean? Like, Eddie and I can be awful. We can be like,
no, you guys both set the tone of coming in with such passion for the job and love of the craft that bleeds out. Like,
yeah, it does. But Tricia, you know what I was going to say is that I again bring it back to Michael Reimer.
Yeah.
Michael Reimer had this uncanny ability to be in both Eddie and my faces with total confidence and tell us we were full of shit if he needed to, and then turn around and nurture someone who'd never experienced how to do a moment like this ever in their lives or thought they would be standing in that position.
Right.
And he could be very comfortable with both. And I watched him like a hawk at the beginning because I approached this like, you better not screw with us or with me or with this story or where are we here? You know what I mean? And I felt protective of all of this group. So I was really like watching, and I was very impressed with he planted the right seeds for the old timers to be able to say, oh, we can work the way we like to work here. No one's going to come in and try and make us do stuff.
Right.
They're going to help us elicit the truth, right? And they're going to have brilliant ideas. That's all we need. But also, this person will take care of these young talents that have been perfectly cast, that are clearly talented. But if they have the wrong director, this right. could go not so well for a while.
Right, because they may shut off or they may like...
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. And exactly. and so I just feel like he needs to be in the equation of this conversation as to why that succeed, you know, the beginning of that. He planted that garden and then it just... And then by the, you know, the end of the first season, there's no director that could tell any of them anything. Which is where you kind of want your actors to be there. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because then when a really good director does come in, you've got an actor who knows how to assess them and then can go, I surrender. Do mm-hmm. whatever you want with me. Let's dive. Like you said, like jump off. And we somehow will land softly, hopefully. Anyway, I'm now babbling. I sound like Michael Trucco.
You're gobbledygook.
Gobbledygook is starting to emerge. We must.
Hybrid Mary has shown up. Well, we should wrap this up. We should.
Yeah, because you don't want any more me doing this.
Oh, no. I would listen to like 5 more hours of this. I have no place else to go, Mary.
I know. I do, but it isn't very exciting.
But thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Oh, and, no, my pleasure.
And taking this last walk.
Thank you for thinking of me. I was so pleased to get the email and go, oh, my gosh, I haven't done one of these in quite a while. So thank you.
Yes. You've been very active on social, sort of just pushing for causes that you're passionate about. Is there any you'd like to shout out before we bid you a fond adieu?
Well, we're all shouting out the funding and the support from Michael Hogan and Susan Hogan and their family. Mm-hmm. And that is, you know, we're all clear about that we will continue to support that extraordinary family. But I also have a cause that's dear to my heart that I've been working through the pandemic. The Rosebud Indian Reservation in South Dakota, mm-hmm. where I have friends there that I met when I shot Dances with Wolves that were crawling in the grass, like the scene that got ripped off. And a dear, dear friend of mine passed away right at the beginning of the pandemic, and we started a fundraiser in her memory. So it's called the Kathy Boyd Memorial Fundraiser, and it's now subtitled I can't remember what we subtitled it, but it's basically fundraising to support the tribe through COVID. And there's been so much beautiful work done, and we've just been able to support so many different aspects. But as you know, at the moment, North Dakota, South Dakota, Wisconsin, these states are beginning to get absolutely creamed. And when, in the beginning of the pandemic, when the idea was, you know, stay home, wash your hands, you know, there are people living on the reservation in South Dakota, both Pine Ridge and Rosebud, who don't have running water. So the whole concept of washing your hands a lot, like there's so much work that needed to be done to support these extraordinary people. So if you feel like, go to KathyBoydMemorialFund.com and, you know, check in with us, because we'll be staying with this beautiful group of people through this whole thing. Thanks.
Yes. No, that's lovely. And thank you, Mary. This has been a treat and a joy. And yeah, if we had to have somebody to ride along with us in the finale, I'm glad it was you.
Oh, thank you. Yes. Me too.
Yay.
Okay. All right, guys. Well, stay safe, please.
We will do our best. We will
Ask
do our best.
Yourselves. Wait a couple of weeks, kids.
It's going to be a bumpy ride.
But
I hope we find a soft place to land.
I do. That's a good way to think about it.
Yeah. As always, we want to thank Bear McCreary for his fantastic theme song, the good folks at Sci-Fi Wire for allowing us to ramble these past 70 some odd episodes. Thanks to Brett Boehm for doing the sound and making it sound good. Before him, thank you to Alex Sarche, who did that job previously. Some folks at Sci-Fi, Matt Romano, Harry Sultan, Matthew Chiavelli, and Jesse Murray, who first made all this happen. And to every single member of the cast and crew who has given us hours and hours of their time to let us just wax philosophic and also make dumb jokes. Thank you to everybody. Thank you, Fiona, for parading your ass in front of the Zoom camera all the time. And thank you to Tricia for agreeing to do this with me. This dumbass idea that came about primarily because you are in the first and last scenes of the show. If they didn't have that last scene, I'm not sure I would have thought we should do a podcast.
Well, thank you to you, Mark, for coming up with the idea and proposing it to me in London. And being the eloquent one throughout this entire thing to my babbling and losing my train of thought, which happens all the time.
We'll always have London, Tricia.
We'll always have London. yes, I'm gonna thank you, and thank you for remembering everyone to thank, because I would have probably just started crying and not done it. So, yeah.
Yeah. So we have one more in the tank. We're going to do the plan. Not sure when that's going to come to you, but we will need to recover.
We might have a few Cylons with us for that one.
Never can tell. But thank you to everybody who has listened to every episode of this. And even if you only listened to one episode, it has been one of the great pleasures of my life to get to do this. So thank you, everybody.
Oh. So say we all.
So say we all.